This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhead of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to live shows or to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen to us live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. It's a pleasure to have Daha Jemiah back with us tonight. This is a young man that in late 2003 became weary of the overall failure of the U.S. media to accurately report on the realities of the war in Iraq for the Iraqi people and the U.S. soldiers. Dahed went to the Middle East to report on the war himself. Since then, he has become world-renowned for documenting the human cost of the Iraqi war. Now he tells how the human cost of war affects the warriors of the greatest military on earth and that of the United States of America. His book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and their deployment, take a public stand. But how deep does the current of resistance run? What makes soldiers decide to go AWOL, file for conscientious objector status, and even serve sentences in military prison for their acts of refusal? Hello, Dahed. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Dahed, refusing to deploy and going AWOL is a movement that's been growing by leaps and bounds. Can you tell us what some of the reasons for that is?
We are seeing a very dramatic increase, and really there's two primary reasons for this at this point. One is the fact that both of these occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan do not have an end. There's no definitive way that soldiers in the military today can measure what is progress, when are we going to get out of here, is there a date, what is victory. And so there are these seemingly unending occupations, and that's really destroying morale across the military, whether someone is skeptical of the occupations to begin with, or even with folks who are very pro-war and ready to go over there and do what they're told. It's very much affecting morale, the fact that neither of these occupations has an end in sight. And then the second main reason is that the Veterans Administration, of course, when soldiers come back home, they're simply not getting the health care that they need. So they come home in very, very bad shape, whether with psychological or physical problems, very much needing assistance. And then the average wait at the VA is 6 months long. 1,000 veterans every single month under supervision of the VA are actually trying to kill themselves. 18 veterans a day are killing themselves. So it's a catastrophe. And, of course, this is very well known throughout the military, that if something happens to you and you go to the VA and try to get help, you're basically not going to get what you need, odds are. So these were really two factors, of course, then against the backdrop of this massive escalation that we're watching happening in Afghanistan right now.
Well, you know, Dahed, as a journalist and as a man that has gone back there, seen it all, and talked to many of the people there, both in Iraq and, I believe, in Afghanistan, can I ask you what you think the purpose of Iraq is? Obviously, our soldiers certainly are confused about it.
Well, it's very simple. It's oil. It's geostrategic positioning of the U.S. military. It's an attempt to further expand the U.S. empire project, and it's a very similar agenda in Afghanistan as well. I mean, we don't have to look far to find the national security strategy of the United States, which is really the key policymaking document when we talk about what is U.S. foreign policy. And the national security strategy states very explicitly, and people can get online and go read this for themselves right now, it states very explicitly some of the missions in the national security strategy are for the U.S. to go into countries and open up their markets and create more free markets and a larger consumer base and basically in this way continue to expand U.S. hegemony over the planet. So there's that. And then, of course, if we turn to the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, a Pentagon document that shows us how is the U.S. military going to be used to facilitate the national security strategy. And this document tells us very explicitly that the military will be used to go into these countries and basically bring these people into the international system, of which, of course, the U.S. is controlling.
Well, you know, you're talking about these documents, official documents of our Congress and other areas in our government. You originally went to Iraq to shed light on behalf of a media coverage of the war that you felt was inadequate. In light of information such as you're talking about right now and this kind of documentation and the blatant reasoning for us being in Iraq, do you believe that there is a deliberate suppression of information?
Well, absolutely the U.S. military and the Pentagon and the policymakers in D.C. do not want people to really have a clear understanding of what is U.S. foreign policy, because I think that most people in this country, if they fully understood that both these disastrous invasions and occupations are really all about economics, it has nothing to do with national security, it has nothing to do with taking care of people here, it has nothing to do with taking care of people in either of those countries, it has everything to do with corporate power and increasing the bottom line of corporations that are profiting off of war and opening up broader markets for other multinational corporations. And so I think that this is why we don't see, for example, any real reporting on any of the mainstream media in the U.S. about, well, let's quote directly from these documents that talks about, you know, economics and opening free markets and incorporating other countries into the international system and this kind of thing. Because I think that, you know, if we really had the facts of what this is all about and what it's truly costing the military and people in this country and people in those countries abroad, I think, you know, if we got that information consistently, this government would be in big trouble. I mean, the people would, I think, be rightly outraged and probably hopefully start taking corrective measures, action to really try to correct the situation. So it certainly does not behoove the government to really, you know, have this information get out very, very far and wide. Of course, then we have a very complicit mainstream media that is very obedient in making sure that that doesn't happen.
You know, Dahir, this issue of resistance, do you think, now have there been any statistics as to whether or not it's different in this war as opposed to previous wars, as opposed to Iran, Vietnam, Korea?
Well, it's a very different situation now, and we do have some statistics I can point to, but first, you know, I always want to be really clear that when we talk about resistance that's happening in the military today, there's in no way, shape, or form can we compare it to what was going on in Vietnam, but, you know, mainly because of the draft. We don't have a draft today, so you don't have a large segment of the population that's being forced into the military basically against their will, which was really created a extremely fertile grounds for the massive GI resistance movement during Vietnam that really helped bring that war to a total end. So not having the draft means there's really, you know, there's not this key impetus that could create a GI resistance movement. But that said, you know, we do have a poverty draft. We have the majority of the people joining the military today are doing so out of economics because there's no other jobs. This may be the only way they're going to be able to go to college. This might be what they hope will give them technical training, this kind of thing. So with the poverty draft, that means we still do have a pretty large segment of people in the military that are, you know, not super ecstatic about being there. They're there first for kind of their own economic reasons and second for other maybe patriotic reasons, if you will. So, but that said, you know, that base and then coupled with what we were talking about earlier around you know, kind of the demoralization that's happening within the military and the fact that there's no end in these occupations, and we still have over 130,000 soldiers on the ground in Iraq, and that number is going to be stay the same through at least the end of the year and, you know, well into next year. And then, of course, we turn over and look at Afghanistan. You know, back in 2002, we had less than 6,000 troops in that country. Here we are in 2009. By the end of this year, we'll have 10 times that number. We'll have over 68,000, and now they're calling for as many as 45,000 more in addition to that. So what this means is more and more soldiers are being sent into combat. And really, now, when we look at the statistics, we are seeing a massive increase in the number of people going absent without leave. So the people going AWOL and people deserting, according to the Pentagon, in fact, we've seen a very, very steady increase in this. And in fact, we saw a 42% increase of people going AWOL in the Army just in 2007 alone. From 2006 to 2007, a 42% increase. Every single year, we're looking at anywhere between 5 and 12,000 people who are going AWOL from the military. And since September of 2001, we've seen now in excess of 55,000 people in the military who have gone AWOL. And these numbers are increasing as we speak.
Dad, why do you suppose more people are going, and more soldiers are going AWOL as opposed to requesting conscientious objectorship?
Well, mainly because while the military does provide an avenue, they do have interestingly, a support structure set up to where if someone does want to file for conscientious objector status, that is available. Interestingly, most people in the military don't avail themselves in it because they don't know that it exists. I literally just went and sat through a court-martial of an Afghanistan war resister who was had filed for conscientious objector status, and he literally said, look, I didn't know, we weren't given the training for this, I didn't know it existed, or I would have applied a long time ago. And then, of course, we look at a situation where how long it actually takes if someone does want to file for CO status, that we're looking at a process that takes upward of a year to complete. So oftentimes when people do file for CO status, they're literally in a position then where they then are told, for example, by their commander, well, you know, you can go ahead and apply for this, but it'd actually be faster for you to go ahead and deploy with your unit, because then you'll be back home here with your family before you had actually finished your application process for being a conscientious objector.
Well, I was under the impression that it actually took a little bit longer, like about 2 years, in order for someone to become a designated CO. And one of the things that as a mother of and a grandmother, our concern is that some of the requirements for conscientious status is that you have a lifelong history of being opposed to war. And so
that's actually not the case. Actually, at any point, anyone in the military who based on moral or spiritual grounds decides they are opposed to all war, they can then apply for conscientious objector status. So, in fact, like the fellow I mentioned earlier, who I sat through his court-martial, he'd actually been in Iraq and then come back and then filed for conscientious objector status. So, technically, the way they have the structure set up in the military, you can apply for that at any point. Literally, even if you're in a combat zone, then you can, at least in theory, go ahead and apply for CO status.
I see. Okay, then that's interesting, because to be quite honest with you, my family has already started a file on our grandchildren in the event of future wars, because from my understanding and from everything that I am witnessing, these wars are escalating. We are not winning. We're not leaving. We're not anything. We're just basically, it's more of the same. And, at this rate, perhaps the PNAC, papers were right, that these multi-wars are going to continue for years. The original estimates, for the entering of Iraq, the conservative estimates, was an occupation of 20 to 50 years, Dahid. Do you agree that is probably a pretty good guess?
I think so. And, you know, it's really, at this point, we don't even have to do much guessing because, you know, we look at Iraq. We're looking at even Barack Obama before he was elected president and certainly long before he was inaugurated. I mean, his security advisors were calling for a minimum of between 50 and 75,000 soldiers in Iraq until at least the end of his first term. And certainly they want to lower the number, but if you talk about when this occupation will ever end, or if we talk about Afghanistan, same thing, we are looking at decades. You know, we had a British general come out less than a week ago saying, yeah, we're looking at a 40 to 50 year occupation in Afghanistan. You know, because, you know, if the U.S. empire project is going to carry forward, they have to have control of both these countries. They have to prop up their U.S.-backed little puppet governments like they're doing in both countries right now, and then maintain the military bases there to secure access to the reserves. In Iraq, it's to secure access to the second largest proven oil reserves on the planet. In Afghanistan, it's to secure access to the pipelines that are going to be used to ship oil and natural gas through that country. And, of course, you know, within a world of dwindling resources, it's now a multipolar world. The U.S. is no longer the sole superpower, so they can't wield that big stick. Now they're looking at, you know, threats from the European Union, from Russia, from China, from India, all these countries that are going to need these resources as well. So the U.S. has rushed in there, planted their bases, and they're there to stay. And again, when you look at U.S. foreign policy documents and then listen to what people are saying, it's all right there. I mean, even back when George W. Bush was still in the office of president, I mean, we had a situation there where I can't remember if it was him or someone else in his administration was talking about the occupation of Iraq, and they said, well, actually, when we talk about the occupation of Iraq, we need to be thinking about that in terms time-wise of the occupation of South Korea. And, you know, so how long has that been going on? We're looking at, you know, a minimum 40 years right there. So, you know, and again, this is not a new thing. We look at where are these U.S. bases around the world and how long have they been there? How long have the bases been in Japan? How long have they been in Germany? So this is really just more of the same.
Exactly. There are so many questions that I want to ask you about the book itself, but there's one, but since you brought it up, how do you view President Obama's stance regarding those that refuse to serve or desert the military as compared to Bush? Is there any difference, and in fact, is there any difference or real change, and I'm using my fingers as quotation marks here, change, the Obama word, is there any real change? Is there any difference between the two administrations in this area?
No, there's not. In fact, there's really no little difference between the two administrations in just about any area, but especially with foreign policy. The two documents I mentioned earlier, those have not changed one iota between the administrations. It doesn't matter who's president. Those stay the same. They're amended at certain times every several years, but of course that hasn't happened yet because it hasn't come due. But I think that really underscores, like, you know, we're looking at policy. We're looking at an empire project here. It doesn't matter who's at the helm. We're having the same policy carried out. And we, again, let's talk about a little bit more of this so-called change that Obama was going to bring. Well, he didn't change Bush's Secretary of Defense and the U.S. Secretary of Defense and Robert Gates. He didn't change any of the documents we've been talking about. He didn't change most of the high-ranking people in positions of power in the Pentagon and the Department of Defense, and the highest-ranking generals in the military. All of these are the same people. We're looking at the same policy, the exact same policy in Iraq. He's just carrying forward with the policy that Bush had going. In Afghanistan, the only change that we've seen is massive escalation. And in regards to how they treat, how the Bush administration versus how the Obama administration might treat war resistors, again, no change whatsoever. There's literally not one bit of change there, which actually shouldn't come as a surprise because this is a man who basically ran on a platform of being anti-war and bringing both these occupations to an end and, of course, has done the exact opposite.
I believe in the foreword written by Chris Hedges, who is too a very well-known war journalist. Chris said, called it continuing the folly of the war on terror.
Well, and that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a situation where the Obama administration is just continuing to race headlong forward with this policy that, you know, all of us could see under the Bush administration. This is a totally failed policy, and that's why I think Obama was as popular as he was during the campaign, because he was really giving people hope and at least pretending as though he was going to make massive radical changes. And instead, we've not only carried forward, but increased the pace in Afghanistan. And, you know, let's be real clear about Afghanistan. I mean, this is a place that the Russians, for example, who, you know, basically met the end of their empire in Afghanistan, they coined the term. They now refer to Afghanistan as the place where empires go to die. And we look at the fact that, you know, Genghis Khan could not control Afghanistan, and neither can the United States.
I'm trying to think if it was there was one other leader, I believe it was Churchill, that said that anyone would be a fool to go in and try to fight the Afghan people, because you can't win in a country of warriors. That's what they do for sport in Afghanistan. I mean, to them, it's not going to be a concern that they're going to continue fighting. You know, there's so many. Let me ask you. That had recently, and I found this story to be especially compelling, in light of journalists like you that have such a great integrity when it comes to portraying the truth as it appears on the ground. There was a young Lance Corporal Bernard, a 21-year-old soldier that died, and photos of his body were reported in the media. The AP reported in a story that it decided to make the image public because, against the wishes of the parents, because it conveys the grimness of war and the sacrifice of young men and women fighting it. Do you agree that we are too sheltered by all of the lovely, peaceful images of war?
Oh, there's no question. You know, rather than actually seeing what war looks like and getting an idea of what it tastes like and feels like and smells like, you know, it's glorified. You know, it's flag waving. Let's look at the tanks going down the street. Let's look at some soldiers firing some guns, you know. But in reality, war is what's happening on the other side of that stuff. War is what happens when a tank shell goes into a civilian home and basically eviscerates, you know, all of the people inside. I mean, we're talking about babies getting their heads blown off. We're talking about rape. We're talking about, you know, the most awful things you can possibly imagine, you know, watching your family completely incinerated in front of your eyes by a U.S. cruise missile. I mean, this is what war really is. And so I think, you know, the fact that that photo was showed and it caused the uproar that it did, and it wasn't even a dead soldier. It was someone with a very serious wound. But believe me, you know, you can look at any media overseas, especially Arab media, and see regularly what war looks like. You're going to see lots of dead bodies, and you're going to see lots of wounded people, because when there's violence and there's things happening, then, you know, we need to show what it looks like. That's theoretically our job as journalists, not sheltering people, not showing what war is. And the reality is that, you know, people really need to see this. And I think if people in this country had a lot clearer understanding of what war really looks like, that it's hell on earth, it should be avoided at all costs. And if you are going to then become active in it, then you need to really see what it looks like and what it really does to human beings, both those in the U.S. military and those on the receiving end of what the military is bringing into these places. So absolutely, I think it's a great thing that photo was shown, and you know, realistically, that kind of thing is happening every single day in Iraq and Afghanistan. So therefore, we should be having those pictures front and center on TVs, on newspapers, and everywhere else they can be shown on a daily basis. You know, until these wars come to an end, people need to be acutely aware of what their government's doing overseas.
Well, and one of the things that a lot of people may not know here is that images such as these are being portrayed all over the world except for America, because I believe it was after Vietnam that we had deemed that the media had overstepped its boundaries, and that we as a society here were far too sensitive to have to witness such horrific acts, even if we committed them. And I found that to be a very interesting statement. Let me ask you, Dahid, one of the, now I have interviewed Aaron Licata and many other resistors on this show. And one of the most interesting things that I always hear is the most profound impact that they have is these attacks, these military attacks on civilian homes. These raids on homes seem to be one of the chief offenses against their psyches and what they're doing. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and what you hear?
Well, I hear the same thing, and especially working on this book and then in all of the continuing articles I'm doing now in the wake of the book that, one way or another have to do with GI resistance. I'm hearing the exact same thing. I mean, really, for example, I was just up at Fort Hood in central Texas, the biggest U.S. base on the continent, and also the most heavily deployed U.S. base on the continent. I met a guy there who'd served a tour in Iraq, had been in combat, had killed people, had seen people killed, and had his friends killed, and this guy named Michael Kern, and he's still active duty in the military, and he said, you know what, I went over to Iraq believing all the propaganda that we were there to liberate these people and save them from terrorism, and then I, was going out on patrol, and me and people in my unit, we were killing people. We were killing kids. We were killing civilians. We were killing women. And I realized after doing that for a bit, doing these home raids day in and day out, he said, I realized we were the terrorists. And then the other factor is that I run into, it's real common with soldiers who've served over there, is that they, once they have some interaction with Iraqis, whether it be an interpreter working with the military or if they actually do go into a home and actually start talking to the people, that they realize, oh, guess what? They're human beings, just like us. And actually, they're quite nice, and they offer us tea, and they're kind to us, even though we're occupying their country. And that
you mean
that
they're not really sitting around trying to devour their children, their unloved children?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Quickly the propaganda disintegrates. It's just obliterated by what these people see when they go over there, in terms of the violence they're being asked to perpetrate, as well as then the kindness of the Iraqi people or the Afghan people. And so that really puts them at odds then with their mission of like, okay, well, now why are we here and what are we doing here? And the second, another Marine, Brian Kassler, who's in the book, who served in Afghanistan and then two tours in Iraq, he said, basically dissent starts when you start asking yourself, why am I here? What am I doing? What are we doing here? Because that's when it all starts to fall apart. But when you're a soldier, when you start thinking for yourself, because when you start really asking those questions, same applies for U.S. citizens. When you start really asking those questions, then you hold that up to the propaganda and what the government's saying and what the media is saying, and there's this huge disparity. And then, at some point, something's going to have to give.
There is, I was just trying to look it up in the book here. I have it marked here. I'll have to find it in just a second. But I wanted to ask you about a particular, statement that I heard. What is search and avoid?
Yeah, this is a kind of moniker that was used very heavily in Vietnam when people, soldiers in that war were so disgruntled and they'd be sent out on patrols. And rather than actually going out and carrying out the patrols, they would do, instead of search, which patrols oftentimes referred to as search and destroy missions, they renamed them search and avoid missions because they would go out and basically do fake patrols. And rather than actually doing patrols, they would basically just go hide out somewhere for the amount of time they were supposed to be patrolling and then go back to their base. So the same thing's happening now in Iraq and has been from almost the very beginning, but it's become quite rampant as the occupation has drug forward. And that basically looks like, and how I heard about it was I was actually on book tour for my first book, and I met a guy, a veteran, came to one of my talks, and he was still active duty at the time. He was a corporal in the Army, this guy named Phil Aliff, and he started talking to me about his time in Iraq and talking about how troop morale was very, very low, and so they started doing what he called search and avoid missions. And he said, literally what we would do, because we were all completely disgruntled and morale was low and we didn't believe in the mission. And so we would go out to the end of our patrol route. We'd find a big open field, and then we would phone in the base every hour and tell them, yeah, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. We'll talk to you in an hour. And he said, we were doing that every other day. And he said, I knew tons of other people that were doing the same thing. And I started meeting more and more veterans while I was on the book tour. A couple weeks later, met another guy. Same story, different part of Iraq, different time of the occupation. And then this just kept going, and I realized, wow, this is rather shocking, and no one's reporting it. And the deeper I dug, the more types of resistance I found, and it all started with the search and avoids.
Well, very interesting. Here's the little bit that I wanted to read off from your book. It was by Shanann Suarez Diaz, a resistor, and he revealed, while individual subversive actions he had noticed in Iraq, I saw in the bathrooms people would leave fuck the war or fuck the U.S. Marine Corps, or what does the United States Marine Corps stand for? Uncle Sam's misguided children. And that was what I could think about, is that they are misguided children. And one of the other, and what I hear often is we felt betrayed by our government. What we were told and what is on the ground are two different things.
Right, and that's exactly the disparity I was speaking to, that soldiers, you know, are more and more confronted with this, that, you know, because they're, of course, as much as anyone in this country, they're affected by and the propaganda. It's really, really aimed at them. You have to have an obedient, basically brainwashed mass of people in the military that are going to do whatever the government tells them to do, even when it's in total violation of international law and total violation of even our own constitution. And so, again, you know, people over in both these occupations are confronted daily with this disparity. And that really is, you know, we talk about what is causing the resistance and what are some of the commonalities that these resistors have with one another. And it certainly is just, you know, people that kind of start thinking for themselves and asking, you know, what are we doing here? And maybe this is against the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and I'm actually being asked to follow unlawful orders, and maybe I'm not supposed to be doing this.
It truly is amazing. We have some questions from our listeners. Well, Ellen in Texas, Daha, asks, can Daha give Americans an idea of what a typical day in Iraq is like since he's been there? And, for instance, are there constant bombs going off, fear of being killed or raped, lack of utilities, medical, food, water, just kind of an overall look at what Iraq, a day in Iraq is like?
Well, it, you know, certainly it would depend on what part, but I spent most of my time in Baghdad and in central Iraq, and I'll speak to that, but I know that this applies to most of the country outside of the Kurdish-controlled semi-autonomous region of the north. And I was just there earlier this year as well, and what I was shocked to see, it was my first time back there in actually 4 years, and I was actually shocked to see that, first of all, when we talk about the infrastructure, that actually electricity availability was lower than it was last time I was there, as was the availability of jobs, as was the availability of safe drinking water and decent medical treatment in the hospitals. That, for example, the average house in Baghdad had about 4 hours of electricity on the national grid per 24 hours. Literally, two out of three Iraqis do not have access to safe drinking water. We're looking at an unemployment rate that vacillates anywhere between 40% and 70%. And then as far as violence, while overall violence had somewhat subsided comparatively, but again, let's be really clear about, you know, overall what we mean by a lower level of violence, because we're talking about, instead of between 200 and 300 Iraqis a day being killed throughout the country, we're looking at between maybe 1 and 3 dozen a day. I mean, and we still have, even we've seen just in the last couple of weeks, we still have huge catastrophic attacks on a regular basis. I mean, I was there for a month earlier this year, and almost literally every single day that I was there, there was a car bomb that went off somewhere just in Baghdad alone. Almost every day I could hear gun battles, clashes somewhere around Baghdad. You could literally hear this happening total chaos. People are afraid. Kidnappings definitely continue. But again, with the media attention really, really shifting now a bit over to Afghanistan, you know, and of course with the propaganda of the Obama administration, well, you know, things are great in Iraq. We're really making progress there. We're going to start drawing down troops. It's really kind of diverted people's attention away. And the reality is there's still over 131,000 U.S. soldiers there. They're not pulling out any troops. We still have these massive, massive bases, a massive, massive embassy. And the situation, again, when we talk about so-called lower overall violence, the situation is far, far from resolved. In fact, I just read a report in an Arab media outlet that they did an interview with someone in the Iraqi resistance who claimed they're still carrying, the Iraqi resistance is still carrying out at least 100 attacks a day on occupation forces.
Wow. Unbelievable. Well, that's a day in Iraq. Mary in Washington has a question for you, Dahu. A couple of them, actually. She asks, is Dahu Muslim? And how does he feel about the way American soldiers have disrespected the people of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, to the first question, I would answer, does it matter? And then I'll say, no, I don't practice any religion. I was raised Catholic, but I'm not, I don't consider myself Catholic. But again, I think we need to ask ourselves why someone's religion would matter regarding reporting or really anything else for that matter. Mm-hmm. But to the second question, which was how did U.S. soldiers interact with Iraqi
people? She asked, how do you feel about the way American soldiers have disrespected the people of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think that's a situation that's a direct result of really the dehumanization that goes into when someone joins the military. I mean, basically, boot camp is about brainwashing people and turning them into murderers. And in order to do that, to get someone to where they're going to go deploy overseas in a foreign land and then be willing to go raid people's homes and kill people and this kind of thing, is you have to dehumanize the people in that place where they're going. And that's part of boot camp. So you dehumanize, the Iraqi people, just like our corporate media helps do a lot. Well, you know, oh, Arabs are just portrayed as bloodthirsty savages kind of thing, just like how Native Americans were dehumanized when the Western expansion began and the genocidal campaign against Native Americans began. So you have to dehumanize these people. Otherwise, it makes it really, really difficult to go commit atrocities against them and certainly to kill them. And so that's kind of a longer way of saying that, yes, U.S. troops in Iraq overall generally consistently really treat Iraqis as less than human, as it's really a horrible thing. But that said, I can say, kind of a silver lining to this dark cloud, that while I was working on this book, I met many, many troops that, again, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, that they, whenever they would have interaction with Iraqis and get to know some of these folks, that actually that would kind of start to dissolve this dehumanization and the prejudice and the fear. And then they would realize, oh, these are just regular folks just like us, and they want the same things, and they feel similarly about a lot of the same things we do. And sure, they have a different language and a different religion, but actually these are people that just like us. And so that starts, again, this kind of waking up process, and soldiers start saying, you know what, it's actually wrong for us to be here occupying their country. It's wrong to be doing these home raids. It's wrong to be treating these people as we are. And so I'm going to start figuring out a way that I don't have to do that anymore.
It is certainly a profound event that we're witnessing. And there's so many more questions that I have to ask you. We're going to take a short break now, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be back. We've got some public service announcements. And we'll be back with Dahu Jamail and his book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in the Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
It's called the Comfort Bike because that's what it feels like when you ride it. Comfortable. The Day 6 Comfort Bicycles produce ergonomic bikes that are the equivalent of a good ergonomic chair, allowing you a natural body position as you use it. With a fully adjustable backrest, wide seat, and a high handlebar design, the Day 6 bikes help you to rediscover the fun and freedom of riding. No hunching over, like when you ride a traditionally designed bike, no matter how fast you're going. Even mounting the bike is easy with a step-through designed frame. Please visit day6bicycles.com to see and learn more about this revolutionary design that is making bike riding a joy again for so many people.
Join the World March for Peace and Nonviolence, an international three-month event spanning 7 continents and over 1 million participants. With endorsements from luminaries worldwide such as President Jimmy Carter, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The World March for Peace and Nonviolence seeks to bring attention to the need to end war and occupation, reduce arms spending, and all forms of violence. Please visit theworldmarch.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. For those of you that have just joined us, our guest tonight is Dahir Jamil, journalist extraordinaire. He just finished his book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Hello, Dahir. Thank you again for being with us again this evening. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
You know, we were talking in the break about something that I have particular issue with, and I was telling you that I'm so pleased that you address the issue of sexism in your book. One of the things that I am totally astounded by is the lack of information that we have surrounding this particular area. Cynthia McKinney, during the presidential debates when she was running for president, mentioned the dirtiest secret of the military, and that was, at the time, she said that 1 in 5 women were either sexually assaulted or raped in the military. Now, any time that I've ever mentioned that to anybody, I am looked upon like I'm totally out of my mind. And I'm serious about this. I have actually been called a liar when I mention some of these issues in shows and things like that. Can you talk to us about this issue?
Well, actually, it's much, much worse than let me give two statistics, and these are really important, especially if there's anyone, a woman who's thinking of joining the military or knows a woman who's thinking of joining the military. One statistic comes from the Veterans Administration, and this report tells us that, according to the VA, one in five women treated at the VA reports having been raped in the military. One in that, there's your one in five. And then there's another report that was released by the Pentagon that shows 80% of women, i.e. four in five women in the military, who are raped or sexually assaulted, never report it. So when we add these together, hold these up against each other, it basically looks to me like if you're a woman and you're in the military, you basically have a guaranteed chance that you will be either raped or sexually assaulted at some point during your time in the military. And when I worked on this book and interviewed a lot of women, not just for the chapter I did on resisting sexism in the military, but other chapters as well, that's exactly what I found, that if on the odd occasion they hadn't been raped or sexually assaulted, they certainly knew of plenty of people that had. So it's a crisis so extreme that, for example, there's one woman in the book named April Fitzsimmons who was in the military back in the 80s, actually, quite high ranking, and, you know, is very supportive of the military and loved the military, but she was sexually assaulted when she was there and has since become very active in an organization called Service Women's Action Network, SWAN, which is a group of veterans and active duty women that help people in the military who are raped or sexually assaulted. And April Fitzsimmons now is basically advising people, said, look, you know, until some real change is made in the military to address this crisis, I'm advising all women not to join the military, that it's just that bad. And there are horrendous stories that I have in the book of women who are raped in Iraq, of soldiers who have raped Iraqis, of just really, really tremendously shocking stories. And this is an absolute crisis, and the military, you know, while there's been some attention paid to it, they really haven't effectively taken the measures necessary to really address this problem. So again, I would mirror what April Fitzsimmons says, and that is, until the military really does address this problem and stop this from happening, and start taking active measures to make this stop, any woman joining the military today, just you'd have to be basically out of your mind.
Well, you know, it actually puts an interesting perspective on why women and the causes of women resistance to these things. It could be based on a lot of different things. Not only do they have to, are they compelled to deal with the lies of our government and why we are being sent there. Not only do they have to deal with all of the same issues that men do, but on top of it, they have to fight off their own countrymen in these issues. It's a horrific, horrific situation. And as Cynthia McKinney said, it is the dirtiest secret of the military. But it's a secret. Why? And for you to address this, and in such a blatant way, I want to congratulate you on that. That was just absolutely wonderful. We have a question from Angela in Oregon. And she asks, where do most Americans who desert go? Do they go to Canada, Mexico, another country, or do they just hide out in the United States?
Yes, the vast majority just hide out here. You know, in going AWOL, it's really not a very dramatic thing. For example, the military doesn't have the facilities to go after people who are AWOL, so generally, if someone just leaves, and that basically, if you go AWOL, it means you just leave and you don't come back. And so if you go AWOL, for example, you might live 5-10 years, but then you get some traffic ticket or something, and then it's going to come up, and the cops are going to turn you over to the nearest base, and then you're going to be put in jail and be waiting on, or in barracks anyway, and waiting on the court-martial. So it's really not a very glamorous thing. It's very easy to go AWOL, but then, of course, over time it becomes a bit more challenging to stay that way. At some point you're going to need to address it and go either try to get a formal discharge or go have your trial or this kind of thing. There's just a couple of hundred soldiers who have gone AWOL and fled to Canada, but of course, Canada now having a more right-wing government, they've become less friendly, exponentially less friendly to troops than they were during Vietnam, so they're actually starting to be shipped out of that country. So it's not a very hospitable place, and so more and more folks, for the most part, are just kind of staying put and trying to lay low here in the United States.
Let me ask you, have you ever heard of the young soldier by the name of Joshua Keyes?
Yes, I have spoken with him, and I write about him a little bit in the book.
Now, for those that don't know who Joshua is, I read about this even before your book. When the story first came up, when we were interviewing some of the veterans against the Iraq War, Joshua had opportunity to witness probably one of the most horrific. Now, this is the funny thing. How do you claim one death is more horrific than the other? So if you get your head blown off in a house bomb, or if somebody shoots your head off and then kicks it around like a soccer ball, and this is what Joshua Keyes claimed to have witnessed during, and that was the event that forced him to go AWOL, and he's currently in Canada. Do you hear some of these stories, these kinds of extraordinarily horrific stories of brutality?
Yeah, this is not uncommon, unfortunately. That is why they did go, because if you're a soldier and you're in Iraq or Afghanistan, you're eventually going to go one of two directions. One, you're going to basically just completely check your brain at the door and totally go with the propaganda and probably with a lot of peer pressure, which are like, look, we just need to follow orders, even if that means raiding people's homes and killing kids. And I've talked to many soldiers who said, I killed a lot of kids over there. And then when I started to wake up and like when they started to become human to me, it's instances like this where, for example, you would compare Josh Key's story, and I've heard this from several people, where they realize, look, we'd kill Iraqis like they were insects. I mean, we just wouldn't even think twice about it, like they were mosquitoes or something. But then an event would happen, and a roadside bomb or something, and one of our guys would be killed or severely wounded. And it was like we would move mountains to get that person to medical attention. We would do absolutely whatever was necessary to get that person help. And then that disparity is like, okay, wait now. Technically, Iraqis are human beings, and technically, American soldiers are human beings. So what is this huge disparity in how they're both being treated when it comes to medical care? So one instance after another like this, but certainly a lot of the reason why more and more soldiers, especially combat vets, are going AWOL is because they've witnessed just too many atrocities when they've been over there.
Mm. Absolutely. You spoke earlier of Camp Hood, and one of the things that I heard mentioned was that there are support groups for resistors cropping up all over. Can you tell our audience where they would find them? How do they work? How do they help people that are interested in resisting or conscientious objection?
Well, first we have the GI Rights Hotline, which is if you Google that, you can find the number, and it's basically a group of people that exist to man the phone so that people in the military can call them and figure out, okay, this is what's going on. I'm opposed to this. How can I get out of it? So whether it's figuring out how to become a resistor or maybe it's just some kind of internal problem within the military that they need some help with. Then we have also the Military Law Task Force, which is a group of lawyers across the country that also works to help people in the military, whether they want to get out or whether they've gone AWOL or whatever the case may be, they're there to help. And then there's other groups like Courage to Resist, a group out of Oakland that was founded by a conscientious objector from the 91 Gulf War, a Marine, and named Jeff Patterson. And this is a group that basically helps marshal resources like media attention, money, and pro bono lawyers for soldiers who want to stand up and publicly refuse orders to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. So these are three groups that are doing really excellent work, and there's many others to help people who are resisting. And you know, I certainly encourage people to, you know, check out these groups if you're interested in seeing what you can do to help someone who might be resisting, who is already resisting. Certainly by supporting these groups and helping them is a very positive thing.
And absolutely, and definitely, you can go to our site. We have been putting a lot of these sites into our political forum, and they will be on Daher Jamayel's. I think it's DaherJamayelIraq.com, if I'm not mistaken, Daher. Is that correct?
Actually, that's true, but dar.org will get people there, too. It's just dahr.org.
Okay, there you go. Now, there's voluminous information there, and some of Daher's articles are really, really fascinating. I highly recommend everybody go and inform themselves. I think that's the other thing that people can do. Even if, as much as we say that the information is hidden, at the same time, it's not that hidden, is it, anymore?
No, it's really not. I mean, especially if people have access to the Internet, it's mm-hmm. really just, it's very, very easy to find this information and get these reports and find out more about these organizations. So, yeah, it's really, especially now, I think, you know, it's pretty clear what's happening, and so certainly people know they have to look elsewhere to find information, but again, thanks to the Internet, that's a pretty easy thing to do today.
Well, that's the story, folks. The will to resist, soldiers who refuse to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's just filled with incredible stories, stories that are heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching, and heartbreaking. You know, these are our children, for those of you that have forgotten. These are our children that we're sending over there. And we don't know who they are when they return. So I suggest that we start finding out real soon. Otherwise, we're going to have a very serious problem on our hands. Sahid, it was a pleasure having you with us this evening. Good luck with your book. And, of course, we will be following all of your work, as we always do. Thank you. And next week's guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Milanin Trask. He's lawyer and leader of the Hawaiian Sovereignty Movement. So that's it for tonight. Thank you, Dahir, and have a wonderful evening, everybody.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief office I saw my people, and they stood there hungry. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.